Welcome to the Alaska Uncovered podcast with me, your host, Jenny Twing Flaming. I bring you accurate, helpful, and entertaining information about Alaska travel and life in Alaska. My occasional co-host and full-time husband, Jay, and I are committed to keeping the Alaska Uncovered podcast ad-free. To do that, we need your help. If you're enjoying the podcast, we invite you to contribute to our tip jar, which is the first link in the show notes. We are so grateful for our listeners, and we wouldn't be here without you. Thank you, and enjoy the show. Are you feeling confused about why it's bad if a cold place warms up? We've got answers today. Our guest today is Rick Toman. Rick works as an Alaska climate specialist at the International Research Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Go Nanooks! Rick has been in Alaska since 1988, working for more than 30 years with the National Weather Service, and since 2018 at UAF. These days, much of his work is focused on helping people who are not scientists understand climate change and the resulting impacts in Alaska. When he needs a break from that, you'll find him digging into his Pennsylvania Dutch family history. Before we welcome Rick and dive in, I want to just add a note from Jay and I that we are operating in reality on this podcast. Climate change is real and it is happening. And this conversation is specifically about what is happening that is unique to Alaska and why it matters to Alaska and also the rest of the world. Rick, welcome to Alaska Uncovered. Thank you for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me, Jenny. Looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got to Alaska more than 30 years ago?
Yes, I can. Way back in the day, in the dim days before the internet, one of the tasks that you did in elementary school was you did a state report, and you had to write to the state tourism office and get their package of information. Yes. And here I am in third grade, and who do I write to? Alaska. I grew up in Southeast Pennsylvania, being the Pennsylvania Dutch boy that I am. And in the late 60s and early 1970s, we in Southeast Pennsylvania did not have much snow or cold. And for a kid that loved snow and cold, couldn't get it outside. So where better to turn than Alaska?
I think, Jay, I don't know what you think, but this might be my favorite Alaska origin story that we've ever had.
But wait, there's more.
What? Okay.
Okay. So then we get to, again, back in the dim days, probably about eighth grade, junior high. You know, what do you want to do when you grow up? Civics class. And what did I wanted to do? I wanted to be a meteorologist in Alaska.
Oh man. So you are an OG nerd. I mean, scientist.
Yeah. So I have always wanted to come to Alaska, and I got to make that dream come true. And I will say that I have been in Alaska now for 36 years, and every day I'm happy to wake up in Alaska.
That is so cool.
That is the best origin story I've heard yet on the show.
Same.
You know, when I was at UAF in 91, I had a friend there, and she got to Alaska by throwing a dart at a map to see where she would go to college. And other than just being really bad at darts, because that's nowhere near the middle of the map, yours is the exact opposite of that. You had a very specific dream and made it happen. That's really cool.
And I think the rarest part of that is I'm still glad it happened.
Right. That's so cool.
You know, Rick, we also share a strange and loose ancestral connection in that my family were all Mennonites, so I have some loose connection to the Pennsylvania Dutch community, ancillary, I guess. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So are you up in the Westridge Center at UAF in the Or where are you out at right now? Are you in Fairbanks?
Yes, I am in my office, which is located in the Akasofu building on West Ridge. That's the farthest west building here on the Trothia campus.
Very
Awesome.
close to the conveniently located next to the ski trails.
Exactly. Yes.
So, Rick, how did you get to be an expert in climate change and in Alaska? I assume when you were in doing your graduate studies and stuff, you probably weren't studying climate change because it wasn't really the topic yet of interest. When did you get into it, and how did you become so specialized?
So climate really has been my interest, since I was a kid. I just really enjoyed kind of that longer view. So if we think of weather as what's happening right now in the environment, so the temperature right now, the precipitation rate right now, climate in essence is really nothing but the statistics of weather, the statistics of what's happening right now. So the high temperature today is really a climate statistic, right? It's the highest value of a whole bunch of instantaneous, what is it right now, temperatures. And so that was really my interest. There's a whole lot more jobs in weather forecasting, and weather, of course, is the building block of climate. So that's what I wound up going into because that was a way to earn a living. But my interest in kind of that longer view it was always there, and I suppose that that is reflected, for instance, in my hobby of family history. That longer view, kind of the history, which certainly falls into climate, is really in part that long view of weather.
Thanks for clarifying that. I think I hear a lot of people commenting on something about a particular day's weather and equating that with climate. And I think what you described it as being the building blocks of climate, that is actually very, very clarifying for folks.
You know, that actually makes me think of something, Rick, that I would love to ask that we didn't talk about before, but I'm thinking about when you hear something like, this is the normal weather for this day. Like, the average high temperature in March in Fairbanks is whatever, the average low in September is this. How does that, do those averages get updated based on what the current weather is? Or like, does that make sense what I'm asking? Like how, if a warmer temperature becomes normal, does that get accounted for when like a forecaster says, oh, it's going to be a cold snap or warmer than normal?
So, great question. And so the answer is, of course, it's rooted in history, right? So, by international convention, climate normals for general purposes are defined as typically the averages over a 30-year period. And
Okay.
again, by international convention, those are updated once a decade.
Okay.
So currently we are using 1991 to 2020 as our 30-year baseline. That will be updated sometime probably in the US in 2031, when we will then increment to the
Yep.
2001 to 2030 normals.
Got it.
That is all rooted in history. Obviously, we could do it differently
Yep.
today. That's the history from, back when pencil and adding machines were the way these
Yeah.
things,
Right.
numbers were crunched.
Right.
So that's
Yeah.
where that comes from.
Okay, cool. That's super interesting.
That just reminds me of how in archaeology the present is defined as 1950.
Yep.
It's a
And it never
scientific convention.
changes.
That's right. That's right.
So Rick, tell us a little bit about what is happening with climate change in Alaska and in the Arctic. So not for those listening, not all of Alaska is in the Arctic. Some of Alaska is in the Arctic, but a lot of it is not. So tell us a little bit about what actually is happening with climate change in Alaska.
So the short answer is everywhere in Alaska is warming, particularly since the 1970s. That's the short answer. The longer answer is everywhere in Alaska is warming, but the rate of warming varies tremendously. For instance, the North Slope of Alaska is warming at about four or five times the rate that, say, the Aleutians or Kodiak Island are warming. Yes, we can come up with a number for how fast is Alaska warming, but that regional variability is extremely important. That shouldn't be a surprise, right? Alaska is a huge area, complex terrain, spanning from 71 degrees north at Utqiagvik down to 52 degrees north at Adak. So a tremendous latitudinal range, even a larger longitudinal range. So yes, Alaska is warming, but the rate of warming varies greatly. Precipitation is increasing. So it's not quite as dramatic as temperatures at this point, but one of the things that we're seeing in recent years in all parts of Alaska are these extreme precipitation events. So lots of very heavy precipitation, could be rain, could be snow, depending on where you're at in the season, in short order, say in a day or two or three. Anchorage, the last two winters, extremely heavy snow. Last several years, we've had two fatal landslides in southeast Alaska produced by excessive storm scale rain. So over just the course of a few days, all these kind of things are changing in Alaska. Temperatures are kind of the poster child, but really everything is changing.
That's I had the experience of so I worked up in Gates of the Arctic back almost 20 years ago now, and a couple years ago I was up on Ellesmere Island doing some archaeology stuff, and the impacts are so shockingly clear there with the coastlines that were just seemed to be evaporating as the permafrost was melting, and then the storm surges would just wash it away. Why are the impacts of climate change so much more clear and obvious in the Arctic?
Well, certainly one of the reason is that the rate of change is so much higher. Alaska, say the North Slope of Alaska, that is the fastest warming area in Alaska. It's not the fastest warming area in the Arctic. That honor, if you will, falls to Svalbard, north of the Scandinavian mainland coast. But the changes are so large, it's really completely obvious. You don't need any statistics. You only need your lived experience to tell not just the annual temperature. That's a pretty abstract concept, right? But most people, it's perfectly obvious if they've been in a place in Alaska for several decades that winters are not as cold. We're not getting the long duration deep cold that we used to. Summers are often warmer. If they're not warmer, then they're wetter. The fall seems to be coming later, the spring overall coming earlier. The snow cover season is shortening. The time of the year when, say, rivers are open for boating is lengthening. All of this in, not just in the in that multi-generation historical perspective, but really in a single adult lifetime, these very obvious changes, both in the land and on the sea.
Do you know anything, Rick, about why there's a more extreme experience in the far north than other places? Is it just because it's colder to start with? So there's more of a change that's visible, or is it something different than that? That's something that I've been kind of curious about.
Yes, we know exactly why that is. And the reason is changes in the frozen part of our environment. So things like sea ice, things like snow cover, things like frozen ground, permafrost. Those are the things, as you cross that freezing point, as you go from snow to bare ground or sea ice to open water, that represents a sharp change in the whole physics of the Earth system.
Yep.
One of the most dramatic examples we see of that is at Utqiagvik, Alaska's northernmost community. In years past, in most Octobers, that sea ice moved in from the north. And so you could get very cold in October because that ocean water was basically sealed off. And now you had ice on the ocean, snow cover on the land. Since 2002, October ice has disappeared from Utqiagvik in October.
Wow.
And that means you've got a heating blanket of ocean water. Ocean water, by definition, can't be colder than about 29 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's any colder than that, it's not water, it's ice. And by the time you get to October at Utqiagvik, there's no appreciable heating from the sun. And that water acts as a heating blanket now. And so since 2002, every single October at Utqiagvik has been significantly warmer than the 20th century average, and that is entirely down to that loss of sea ice.
Oh, interesting. So I'm also hearing inherent in that is that so much stuff in Alaska is dependent on ice. I'm picturing that if you are eating an ice cream cone and it warms up 5 degrees, you don't have an ice cream cone anymore. Where if you're drinking a soda and it warms up 5 degrees, it's still a soda. There's like, it's just a slightly different temperature, but the ice cream cone is no longer what it was. It doesn't have structure anymore. And ice is, that's kind of what I'm picturing from here.
That's an excellent, excellent analogy. In what we would put in jargon, that phase change of water is so important. And it's not like, of course, that snow cover isn't a thing at lower latitudes, but it's not the dominant process the way it is at high latitudes, including most of Alaska.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. 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 So it's like it's not just the warming. It's also the fact that it's warming around a certain point that's really changing, like you said, I think the physics of how the Earth works or how the atmosphere works.
And how water works.
Yep.
So there's that. The other thing is related to that temperature. Of course, when people think of greenhouse gases, usually you think of carbon dioxide. That's the big one, right? But did you know that water vapor is also a variable, an important greenhouse gas, but it's the only one of the greenhouse gases that the amount varies greatly, because air that is cold can hold much, much less water vapor than air that is warm. So even a few degrees increase in the Alaska or Arctic air temperature, say in winter, that air then can hold much more water vapor.
Right.
Powerful greenhouse gas. And it also allows the potential for more cloud formation.
Yep.
So all of these things are conspiring to produce this much greater warming in Alaska and the Arctic as a whole. And that's known, again, as a jargon term, as that Arctic amplification of climate change.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. So, Rick, I know you've already kind of alluded to this quite a bit, but I would love to just ask you really explicitly something that I've had quite a few people ask me when I'm working as a tour guide or just in life, which is like, why is it bad for a cold place to get warm? I mean, if you live in Fairbanks and, you have these long cold slaps, that is what it feels like, these cold snaps, nobody likes it when it's 50 below. So except musk ox. So like, what's the big deal if it get, why is it a problem for Alaska to warm up?
Well, it is a problem on a lot of fronts, in the sense that Alaska, our ecosystems, our plants, our animals, and even modern Euro-American society is built for cold.
Yeah.
Sticking in Fairbanks, every house, every building is built to contain heat within it. When it's 50 below, you don't want to be heating the great outdoors.
No.
However, now, okay, so now it's only, say, 10 below in the winter. That's great. Let lower heating bills, right? But what happens when it's 85 to 90 for days on end in the summer? You still got
Yeah.
a house that's built for containing the heat. And so we wind up with heat problems at much lower temperatures than would be a problem in the lower 48, as we saw in 2019 in Anchorage, which is much less used to very warm summer temperatures than interior Alaska. Temperatures in the upper 70s were causing heat problems because buildings are built to contain heat.
Yeah.
Of course, with our ecosystem evolved for cold, we have the spectacle now, one of the iconic species of tree species of the boreal forest, white spruce. Eastern interior Alaska is now becoming too warm for them. Now, that doesn't mean the trees all die at once, but as wildfire comes through, those trees are not favored to grow back because summers are too warm for them. Conversely, in western Alaska, we see that spruce trees are spreading very quickly towards the Bering Sea coast. It used to be too cool in the summer to support tree growth. Now it isn't. Similarly, with animals, we see, of course, animals are spreading into areas that they didn't previously live, say moose on the North Slope or beavers into Northwest Arctic burrow. Animals, of course, don't care at all how we measure temperatures. They don't care at all about normals.
Yeah.
All they do is they live where they can and they don't live where they can't. And
Yep.
these same kind of changes are occurring very rapidly in the seas around Alaska, too, particularly in the Bering Sea. Warming ocean temperatures, decreasing sea ice has meant that we've seen a whole raft of southern Bering Sea fish species, which are really just an extension of the North Pacific. They have moved northward in some years all the way to the Arctic, to the in some years all the way to the Bering Strait. And that is an area that previously was much more of an Arctic marine environment. Those Arctic species are gone. Presumably, they have gone north to find colder water.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how about, I mean, those impacts to animals and plants and stuff obviously affect people. Like overall, can you call out a few of the ways that this climate change is affecting the people who live in Alaska specifically?
Oh, certainly. Things like thawing permafrost. Who wouldn't be thrilled that your ground is not going to be permanently frozen now? Well, we are not happy that the ground is not permanently frozen here in interior Alaska in the Fairbanks area. The Department of Transportation is spending an immense amount of money to repair the same stretches of road every single year as the permafrost underneath them thaws. The roads become like sometimes the analogy of a roller coaster ride is used, but it's actually even bumpier than that. And that is an ongoing process that the state is spending amazing amount of money on. Permafrost thaw is affecting structures, buildings, both really everywhere that permafrost is found, which is more than half of the state is underlain by at least what they call that discontinuous permafrost. So between 10 and 50% of the area has permafrost. And of course, north of the Brooks Range, permafrost is continuous everywhere. As that the area of the ground that thaws in the summer increases, lots of damage, not just to roads, but even to buildings infrastructure that is extremely expensive to repair and replace. I'm going to hazard a guess that when people are doing their 21st century review in the fall of 2099, the cost to the state of Alaska and to the government of the United States from permafrost thaw in Alaska is going to rank right up there amongst the highest expenditures from climate change. Certainly in our indigenous communities, these changing natural resources, plants, animals on land and in the sea are forcing a very rapid adaptation to different species, or for instance, in the case of the collapse in the last few years of both Chinook and chum salmon on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers, a resource that's been available for millennia is now suddenly gone, and that not readily replaced.
Especially when you consider how few resources are in play for Indigenous Alaskans. You know, it's not there's not a lot of alternatives. It's not like there's an agricultural system waiting to jump in and fill in the gaps and stuff. That it seems very dire. A lot of our listeners are folks planning to visit Alaska. Is there any way that anything that you could point out that people might be able to see when they're there, just to witness? Like, is there something when you're on your commute to work that you can see that illustrates climate change going on in Fairbanks?
Well, that is an interesting question. Certainly, for folks, say, on cruises, cruises are having to go farther, for instance, to show people Alaska's majestic glaciers, dramatic decline in glaciers of Southeast Alaska, Gulf of Alaska coast, Prince William Sound. It's not that they're gone, but they're very, very different than was the case, say, 30 years ago. Here in Interior Alaska, I've already mentioned the frost-heaved roads. For folks going to Denali Park in the next year or two, you will be the victim of climate change as the Denali Park Road closed there due to that rock glacier movement there.
That's a great example.
That's directly a climate change related phenomena. That slope had been stable for thousands of years, and now it isn't.
Yeah.
Some of the changes that have occurred are really spectacular or even heartbreaking if you know the way it used to be. One of the most iconic images of climate change to me is if you cast your mind back to the 2019 Iditarod, there's an iconic photograph of a musher coming into Nome. They're on the beach at Nome, and there is open water on the Bering Sea directly behind them. And if you know what that should look like, that is just a heartbreaking photograph.
I do a lot of historic re-photography where I will very, very carefully recreate a historic image. And I've thought about doing a series of Alaska glaciers, but honestly, they're moving so fast backwards that where would I choose my, I could reshoot it again a year later and it would be visibly different from, one of my friends is from Anchorage and we went to do that at Portage Glacier with a photo he had from when he was a kid in the early 80s. And, you can't see Portage Glacier from the parking lot at all now.
I mean, there's a very nice visitor center. And when that was planned, the glacier was there.
Was right. Yeah.
And now it's like there's this visitor center in the, why is this here?
On
it's
a pond.
Nothing.
Yeah.
There's a pond. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Totally.
Yeah. So, Rick, I expect that a lot of our listeners, maybe like myself, can feel kind of overwhelmed by this topic. It's like, You know, it's such a crisis, and it feels so difficult to know as a person like what we can do to change it. And I know that there are things that humanity can do to change it, but it can feel kind of overwhelming as a person, an individual. And I'm wondering if you have any either any advice about navigating that since you're facing this kind of global crisis daily in your work, like if you have any advice about that, and also what you would recommend for good sources of information that are based on science about climate change.
So let's see. So, how to deal with our rapidly changing environment. This is something I struggle with. But to me, I do what I can do, just out of a sense of it's the right thing to do. And I think that's gonna drive a lot of it. This is a global problem, and it is not going to be solved by Rick Toman switching from plastic to paper straws. And but we all have a part to play. Although it's bigger than all of us, bigger than any of us, we all can contribute to the solution, or we can contribute to the problem. And I hope that everyone will contribute to the solution, knowing that just what we do individually is not enough, but we have to be on the right side of history here. The other thing that gives me hope as an older Alaskan is the youth. It is obvious that there is a big generational difference in outlook and approach to what we're facing. And I have every confidence. I won't live to see it, but I'm confident that when the youth of today are my age, that we will be much farther along to adapting and coping, and hopefully ultimately ending this warming that we are in now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I appreciate that optimistic bit there too. I feel the same.
Yeah. And are there, Rick, are there any particularly good resources for learning about information that's related to climate change, either in Alaska or elsewhere? Like what advice do you have about like navigating kind of the media landscape with lots of information, and how do you know what's accurate? What suggestions do you have about that?
Yeah, so there is a lot of junk out there, and there is a lot of good information, and it's going to depend on what you're interested in. This is the portion of the program where I can plug our resources that we have here at
Plug
the
it.
International Arctic Research Center.
And we'll put them in the show notes so people
All
can
right.
find them.
So if folks are interested in just a quick overview, on our International Arctic Research Center homepage, we have a link to our publication series. We have a whole series of publications on Alaska's changing environment. So, where we talk about changing climate, we've got one on Alaska's changing wildfire environment. Brand new one out. We've got a whole series on berries in a changing climate, and we just came out. We, IARC, I did not, I cannot take credit for this, but it's a great publication. Blueberries in a changing climate, cloudberries in a changing climate.
Awesome.
Coming up next, I believe we have cranberries in a changing climate. So we've got this whole series of easy to read. They're professionally designed. These are not scientific texts. They're supposed to be fun, engaging, but they are authoritative. If you want to dive a little deeper, here at the International Arctic Research Center, a couple of years ago, we put together a whole, what do they call these MOOCs, these massive open online course. The fun,
That's a love the name.
it's a fun online course. It's completely free, and you can pick and choose what you want to learn about. You want to learn about more about the changing climate. We've got a whole segment on that. You want to learn about the human geography, indigenous cultures, the political situation in the Arctic. We've got a whole section on that, all completely free. And of course, I also produce an Alaskan Arctic climate newsletter that is, I try to aim it at kind of the interested layperson, and you're welcome to subscribe for that. And it is completely free.
That's awesome. How do we and other people get on your newsletter? Is that from iArc also, or is it somewhere else?
Yeah, that's I put that out on Substack right now.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it's just the Alaskan Arctic Climate Newsletter.
Okay, awesome. We'll put a link to that in the show notes along with the International Arctic Research Center. And you said the MOOC classes are also on that website. Yes.
There's a link to them there.
Okay. I'll find them.
And it's called The Arctic in a Changing Environment.
Perfect. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to ask Rick our wrap-up questions about Fairbanks. Hi, everyone. Jenny here. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. If you're listening in real time in April 2024, and you're planning to travel to Alaska this summer, it's not too late. Let me help you make that dream trip come true through one of my planning sessions, or even planning the whole thing for you if you'd like more help. Follow the link in the show notes that's just below the tip jar to book a session with me. Want to do it on your own? That's also awesome. Take my free 4-question quiz to get an itinerary suggestion based on your travel style and your personal dreams for your trip. The link to that is in the show notes too. All right, back to the show.
And we're back, and we're going to do our final wrap-up questions with our special guest live from the Westridge Center of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, Rick Thoman. Rick, we always wrap up with the same questions for folks, and they're not out in your direct area of expertise as a climatologist, but instead as a Fairbanksan. So what's your favorite month in Fairbanks?
What is my favorite month in Fairbanks? Ooh, that is a tough question.
I already know what your answer is because we talked about it before.
In general, my favorite month is whatever month it is now. But if I really have to choose,
that's a great answer.
I'll say, the end of February and the first half of March is a beautiful, beautiful time of year. It's the clear, on average, climatology, the clearest time of year. So auroras are very frequent at night. Yes, it's still getting cold, but the sun is back heating up the air. So really quite delightful for almost every kind of winter activity, whether it's aurora viewing, cross-country skiing, snow machining, or just going for walks in the beautiful sunshine that after overwintering in Fairbanks and having those very short days in December is just a joy. My other favorite time of year is really right around Labor Day, which is the time of peak colors in interior Alaska, in the trees. That's the time of the year all the summer mosquitoes and biting gnats and all that, those are all gone. Days are usually still warm, and we've got those beautiful autumn colors. So that's my long answer to your simple question.
It was very ambassadorial with the... I got to say that the first frost is amazing when it's like killed off all the mosquitoes, but then you get this sense of like, oh wait, I hear the rest coming.
Yep. It is a short season. That is a fact.
Those are the two times of year that I miss Fairbanks the most. I would give the same answer that you did, Rick. Those are really, really magical times. Okay. What's your favorite restaurant in Fairbanks?
Ooh, favorite restaurant. Little known fact, as far as I know, Fairbanks is the Thai restaurant capital of Alaska.
Yes.
And I will go with our Westridge favorite, and so we will say of the many Thai restaurants in Fairbanks, nearly all of them are very good. I will go with lemongrass as my
Good choice.
favorite restaurant in Fairbanks.
You know,
Excellent.
Rick, I think thanks to this podcast, the amazingness of Thai food in Fairbanks is no longer a little known fact. Because
So I'm not the first person to say that.
you are not, no, I am not sure how many episodes we have about Fairbanks, but it's quite a few. It's probably about 10. And I don't know, Jay, if you can think of any exceptions, but I think every single person has mentioned
I think so too.
some Thai restaurant in Fairbanks.
And we
I
did a
agree.
bunch of quick sound bites last October when we were at a conference in Fairbanks, and so I recorded a ton of little 5-minute interviews, and almost everybody mentioned the Thai food.
It was
People
awesome.
from all over the state, and they were like, "The Thai food here is really good." We wanted to make it into sort of a clip of just like a dozen people saying Thai food, Thai food, Thai food, Thai food.
You know, my wife has friends that that at least they used to go to Thailand every winter,
Oh, wow, cool.
and they said that the best Thai food in Fairbanks is in competition with the best Thai food in Bangkok.
That's
Wow.
impressive.
I believe it though. Okay, Rick, final question. It's a toughie. You get a little free time. And what's your favorite thing to do for fun in Fairbanks?
Oh, so much to do. We are at that time of year. Here we are knocking on the door of March. So I'm going to say that every year can't miss International Ice Art Championships in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Especially, I particularly like to go just after dark. When the ice sculptures are lit up, many of them lit up with colored lights, just really beautiful. And having been a dog musher as a younger man, I still like to go see all the dog mushing activities that happen in Fairbanks in March.
Good answer.
Yeah, love it. That is so cool. Well, Rick, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for your willingness to come on the podcast and share it with us. Thank you so much.
You bet.
Absolutely. Really appreciate it, Rick. It's
Hopefully
great
you
to
can
meet
get
you.
a decent show out of all that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.